The aim here is to have a fairly interactive discussion, so if you have questions, feel free to ask them as you think of them. If you're anything like me, you might forget in a few minutes, so don't be afraid to, you know, put your hand up or and signal for the mic if you do have a question. We'd like to have a fairly interactive discussion. And with that, I will let the panelists introduce themselves and talk just a little bit about some of their work with analytics and healthcare, where they, you know, where they see, essentially have them describe why they're up here to talk about this.
Jay Shrini, my current role is CIO of Q Group. We're a molecular diagnostics firm linked with oncology therapy pathways to guide community oncologists for the optimal treatment. My involvement in big data has been with some of sort of the leaders in the field. One is, as some of you may know, Dr. Rees in Pittsburgh. So about 22 years ago, this neurosurgeon, who also wrote exquisite Java code, as well as did programming, managed to create a database when his CEO asked him, and I'm not exaggerating, 20 years ago, using Unix files to create the first EMR. So the question became, when you are able to take both clinical data and financial data and interlink them, what could you do? And I'll just leave it by saying they determined that by getting to that finite level of data, they were able to find out at the University of Pittsburgh what kind of complications occur when you go and make the insertion from the right side of the ear versus the left side of the ear as you're going through the nerves in the neck. And also, they were building up a hospital in Palermo, Sicily. How many bottles of Tylenol would they have to export for that? So my involvement with big data has been over the past two decades, and my gray hairs should show for it.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Radlauer. I am a physician. By background, I'm an electrical engineer and did a lot of software development prior to my going to medical school. I'm an emergency physician for the last 23 years. I'm also the regional CMIO for the HCA hospitals in Colorado. We have six major hospitals in the Metro Denver area. I've done an awful lot of work with HCA for the last 12 years or so on a broad variety of clinical informatics related issues. I'm also the medical director of information for the primary hospital I work at, and the reason I note that is because we have a very active PHO, provider hospital organization. I've been very engaged with that group to help the providers in that group, which number nearly 500, transition from really a group of, you know, independent small businesses to adopting EMRs to start to do clinical integration. And you know, whether ACOs do or don't fully ultimately come true, something's going to come true. And so we're setting the groundwork to make that happen, learned a lot of practical lessons there. I'm also the medical director of information systems for my 230 provider emergency department and hospitalist group. And we've done some very interesting work there with our EMR and a data warehouse and done a variety of reporting across the group in that environment. I've learned a lot in terms of where the rubber hits the road. So really, what, you're talking to a guy that spends a lot of time really interacting with the providers at a very foundational level and trying to make some of these things come true. And I've learned a lot of practical experiences from that.
My first question is, do you ever sleep? That's a lot of jobs. Good afternoon. My name is John McDaniel. I'm the national practice leader for NetApp, really focusing on the provider marketplace. And in that role, my job is really to look at the industry and understand from a thought perspective where it's going. And it's very obvious to me, based on my 23 years as a CIO, a few years as an informaticist, and then working for a number of consulting organizations, that healthcare analytics is going to play a major role in the transformation of where we are now to where I believe we have to go in the future. Now, I've worked with a number of organizations over the last 2 years, not as much as Jay has, over the last 2 years to really figure out, first of all, what is big data? And secondly, how do we capture it? How do we report on it? And how do we standardize and normalize it so that we can really get consistent real-time type of reporting?
Good afternoon. Rich Knopfsinger. I'm the CEO of Active Health Management. It's a population health company that was really founded on clinical analytics and then grew from that into a care management and now population health organization. Prior to that, I ran a company called Envita, which was a clinical decision support company that was sold to Humana that was dealing primarily with that point of care analytics. And one of the things and trends that I see is how do you effectively and timely merge this data, both clinical and claims or administrative data, as well as all the other types of data, lab, Rx, et cetera, and do that in a timely fashion that gets the right information to the right people at the right time.
Hi, I'm Pete Gabriel. I'm a physician and faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm the director of informatics for our radiation oncology department. Before my current role, I spent a few years helping to lead our implementation of an outpatient EMR system, and got very familiar with the back end of EMR data and mining clinical data from EMR systems in that role. Now in radiation oncology, I do a lot of data mining, and I've been very involved in our data warehousing efforts at Penn. I'm probably the youngest and the least senior member of the panel, but I might be relatively closer to the front lines of just trying to deal with some of the practical challenges of getting data out of EMRs, putting it into a data warehouse, and making some use out of it. I'm also involved in a national effort to build a research registry for the specialty of radiation oncology, and so I have some familiarity with some of the challenges and the promises of that type of effort for gleaning insights from a large pool of aggregated data.
All right, thanks everybody. So we'll sort of get started here. As these analytic systems are sort of being deployed to support this sort of new care models that we are, I'm involved in these, to support care models that the industry is sort of increasingly embracing, what can we learn from some of our past use cases to help guide some of our future strategy in deploying these solutions and bringing data together for more coordinated care?
So I'd probably say the three things. Let perfect not be the enemy of good. You're never going to have the right data, and you're never going to have the right metadata. And even if you think it is today okay, it is like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. By the time you manage to validate it, its veracity is going to be lost. So that would be number one. The number two item I would say is that what today we consider as health data is always going to expand. If you think about it, the diet was not necessarily considered that much, nor was acupuncture and other alternate treatments part of the EMRs until more recently. And the third aspect I would say is the fact that it's okay to get small wins to develop. I think we heard this morning from Dr. Tarian. And this question of this is the health learning cycle. Take the hypothesis which you don't know and validate with the data to generate new hypothesis. So it's a virtuous cycle.
Go ahead.
No, you.
You're the physician. I'm the.
No, I mean, I think these are complicated problems, so keep them simple. And try to accomplish some simple things and start to get people engaged. And what I mean by that is start to try to show people data. And in our emergency group, for instance, we've had a lot of success there. And it's been hard just to start to get some meaningful data out of the system that you can share with people. And the other simple thing that I've learned is you have to push the people data in their inbox. And that if you build these things but they have to go find them, it doesn't happen. But if you can get it to them where they want it and say, and press this button for more information, that's been a very useful strategy for us.
Yeah, I would actually, I kind of agree with some of the things Jay said. And I would look at three basic principles. The first one, and I think she was absolutely right, don't boil the ocean. It's too big. Start small. Really understand what you want to do. The second thing is don't do this in isolation. It's not a standalone kind of application. It ties everything together. And more importantly, as you build it and implement it, engage your physicians, because you're going to change the behavior and the way they utilize this information as they care for patients at whatever the appropriate site may be. And the last one is make sure you understand what the trusted source of the information is, because a lot of us don't know what that is, and validate it and verify it consistently so that it doesn't change. So if we're going to rely on this kind of information at the point of care, and I agree it has to be a point of care, around alerts and everything else, it's got to be 100% accurate.
I agree with my panelists. I take a slightly different or a slightly adjusted look at it, break it down into three different areas. What's the data? What's the data that I have access to? What's the workflow? And by the workflow is, how are you going to get that into to whoever the user is? How are you going to get that into their hands? Whether it's within the EMR, EHR, whether it's a portal, whether it's a separate app, how are you going to get that in? Maybe it is paper, you know, but how is that going to get into the user's hands? And then we heard a little bit about this earlier. I'm a huge believer that you need a champion or champions to get adoption. Because if you're just doing it for an experiment and you're just doing it on the side, at some point the funding, the excitement is going to wear out. And so those are the three things, and they work in they're work together, and they're not necessarily sequential. What's the data? How are you going to get it into the workflow? And I use that term broadly. And do I have champions that will help me get adoption?
I would just maybe add a little bit to some of the points that are already made, just to say that it's hard to do meaningful analytics without having good, meaningful data, and it's hard to overappreciate the challenges to getting that. I think especially as the data sets get larger and larger, they're filled with systematic biases that you don't necessarily know are there, because there are variations in the way that our clinical systems are used, and you have fields that are supposed to mean something, but certain people use them in different ways and have different concepts of how they're putting data into the system at the point of care. And to some degree, analytical methods can deal with some of those challenges, but it's really important, I think, to give a lot of thought to how the data is getting collected, and giving people, the practicing providers, the right incentives to put in quality data at the start, because it's, everybody knows garbage in, garbage out, but it's a real problem that's challenging to deal with. And it's a little bit of some people mentioned a chicken or the egg kind of a problem too, because providers they're more willing to take on the extra burden of putting good data in when they see some results of it coming back to them in the form of reports and information that they can use. But then by the same token, if you just start doing analytics and push reports to people with information that's bad, there's no better way to turn someone off of the whole concept if they get some data that doesn't look accurate to them or that they're suspicious of. So balancing, I think, the interplay between putting good data in and then returning the information to people is a real challenge.
I agree with 100% with what you said. Well, one thing I've seen, you've probably seen the work done at UPMC, where they've had physicians start to engage with this, and one of the things they made it very clear on is, as you design this, don't force the physician to go through 73 clicks to get to the desired data, or more specifically, the information they're looking for. Minimize the amount of interface that the individual care provider has to do that. And I think they got several of them down to like 3 clicks. I think that's an important issue.
All right. So I guess to that end, what else can we do? Sorry, I keep using the royal we here. What else can organizations do as they're going through an analytics process to make sure that the use of that data is both relevant and meaningful for physicians who, as we discussed earlier today, are already overburdened with work? How do we, as Pete pointed out, make sure that we're giving them information that they can use and that they can apply, not just to sort of a more global view of providing healthcare, but also as they're providing care for individual patients on a daily basis.
It's preparation, preparation, preparation. What I mean by that is most of it is not just technology. I mean, people who have used DBMotion can relate to that. It is, how do you get even 3 Cerner installations where the same lab test is coded in 3 different ways and manually? I mean, I know in UPMC, thanks to Bill Hogan, who took the time to normalize all that manually, and he was a physician who understood the data, and then in collaboration with the medical informatics team to understand How much do you need to optimize that? How many alerts and rules are you going to need before you have alert fatigue? And I think it is that collaborative way of we the people, by the people, to the peoples, we the physicians, to the physicians. And technology is just an addendum or a side path to be able to do it. But I think getting the content and the preparation for that becomes a very fundamental part of making the technology relevant.
You know, these seem like very highfalutin questions to me. I'm going to just try to boil it down to a couple of real-world experiences I've had in the last number of years. So an early one being when we implemented a system to tighten up access to our information systems because they were wide open and people were looking all over the place they shouldn't be. And I had a role to go out to the providers and say, we're going to go down this path of tightening up what you can see, and we're going to be running reports behind the scenes as to what you're looking at. This was about a decade ago. And all the doctors, well, not all the doctors, but a variety of them said, well, that's not a problem in my hospital. We don't do that. And then we had a celebrity in town get some medical care, and we put the system in place, and we had 73 people across our market access the record. And the moment I presented that information to people, that changed the whole dialogue that day. And it was a really important lesson for me to learn that if you show people real data, especially providers, they're very data-driven people. So if you just say, we're trying to make things better, they say, well, who are you talking to? I've been making things better for 20 years. But if you show them data, they'll act on it. So in our emergency group, we produced reports looking at the use of head CT for nonspecific headaches. And lo and behold, we had a 2.5 difference in the utilization of head CT for no discernible clinical reason. So we just shared that data with the group, and then we spoke to the people that were the high users, and we just watched over 6 months just the volume of head CTs go down quite a bit. So in this area, I'm a big believer in the Hawthorne effect, by the way, which is if you people start to understand you're looking at stuff, you look at a little bit, but you change a lot in theory. And I've seen that happen again and again. I'll tell you that in our PHO, where we are starting to see early, and I'm not good at this stuff, but this risk contracting, right, where the insurers are starting to say on this new contract, we're going to look at whether your diabetics are getting their eye checks, whether they're going to the podiatrist, you know, the old hemoglobin A1C. And what we actually have done to make it relevant to the providers is we actually take the contracts and we look at them and we say, here are the things that we're going to start measuring you on. And they're incredibly receptive to that because they're signatory in effect to these contracts. And so we're showing them this is the data that we're looking at and going to be looking at with you because we as a PHO are trying to, you know, protect your livelihood. So I don't know if that's meaningful or practical to people, but, you know, showing people real stuff that really impacts, you know, their clinical care or their bottom line has been very effective.
So yeah, it seems like it's really a matter of trying to create this kind of culture of data transparency, in a sense, where you are admitting to folks, we're going to be measuring stuff, but this is what we're going to be measuring, so that they're sort of aware of what's happening, and that they also know why this is being done, and sort of what the overall end game is going to be.
I mean,
from
I think,
that.
You know, providers foundationally want to do a great job by people. That's why mm-hmm. you know that's why 98% of them are in it. And if you say, look, it looks like your colleagues are ordering half as many CTs as you with the same outcome, mm-hmm. that they buy into that fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Question.
Oh, sure.
In line with your Eisenberg reference.
Does information have dimensions? Does it have, oh, thank you, sorry about that. Does information have dimensions that you need to be mindful of when you design a system?
Absolutely, there's the metadata, right? So you may, how are you going to use the information? If you're going to use the information more on a generality, let's say for a financial information, I need to decide how many of my beds need to go into ICU versus PCU, having macro levels of that information is fine. But if I'm going to be treating a patient with MRSA, then I need to know exactly how they need to be isolated and where. So I think the same information, depending upon the use of that information, is going to be used in a different way, and therefore the metadata should be able to capture the multiple textures and the contextual information around that data.
Thank you.
Okay, were there any other questions from the audience while we're at it? I wanted to sort of turn a little bit to, you know, I know this is a discussion we had a little bit before, about some of the work that goes into putting together a data warehouse. And specifically, I know that Pete mentioned making sure that the data that's going in there is, to use a word, clean. You know, we have a lot of different systems with a lot of different ways of capturing data, and different systems will do it differently. How do you, you know, make sure that when you're put, you know, first clean up the data, then put it into your warehouse, and then, you know, so I guess sort of go from the next step, pull information from that warehouse into, you know, some of the reports that we've been talking about that will give, you know, anybody within the organization a good picture of why, you know, what you're doing, how and how it's going to have to be changing.
That's a great question. It's probably a $1 million question. And what I advise a number of clients to do is, first of all, create a data governance organization. Understand what data is out there, who owns that data, and also what's going to be the trusted source of that information. And then you start to populate warehouses or warehouse or whatever it might be, repository, a vector database, or whatever. I think the second thing then you start to do is understand what it is, back to the point Jay made earlier, how am I going to use this data? What are the dimensions of data I'm looking at, and how do I really take that information and affect the change care, the care process? One of the things I would also encourage as you go through this process, and it's a, I mean, my methodology is probably a 12-step approach, but one of the things I constantly reiterate to organizations that are embarking on this is go back and look and make sure that data stays clean. And if you look at a number of the organizations, including the largest in the country, they've gone through and started to go back and look at, is my data clean? Is it staying clean? Once I've identified, probably the best on a scale of 5 is 3. So they still haven't figured out how to get it in there, how to get in there accurately, and how to maintain the accuracy of that over time. And that's absolutely essential. So I'll make sure that we make available what I think is a 12 or 13 step approach to get to starting point with a council governing it, all the way to adoption and transformation.
I think it's kind of hard to define what clean means, and to some degree, you know, there are certain types of things that can't be cleaned. See if I could give a tangible example. Let's say in your analytics, you want to do some reasoning about medications that a particular patient has been exposed to. What you're going to have in your source systems is generally orders for medications, which is not the same thing as knowledge that a patient took that medication. You may have in some systems administration records. For things like infusions, but it's, you know, reasoning about the data that comes from a clinical system is challenging because it's inherently, I use the word dirty just because it's an easy word, but that's not necessarily the right description in that there's something inaccurate about it. You know, I can look at a particular patient and see that there's 5 prescriptions for the same drug within a, you know, 2-month period of time. Well, did he get a lot of that drug? Probably not. He probably lost it several times, or, you know, who knows. So those are the types of things that I think makes it challenging to kind of draw conclusions and inferences from the data. And it's hard to account for that just in your sort of effort to put it into the data warehouse.
I would also add that from almost the majority of institutions, you just have a sliver of a view of that patient. You do not have a longitudinal view of that patient. So using your drug, you know, you have a high probability with any patient that they may be taking drugs you have no visibility to, because you just can't get to it. That wasn't prescribed within your organization. It hasn't been fed into the data warehouse yet, any number of things. And so it's not necessarily dirty. It's just a very small sliver of what's going on with that patient.
I'm sorry, go ahead. That's a great point. And in the context of how I'm talking, I'm really talking from an ACO perspective. So I think to have this just from a single acute care facility does have some benefit, but not significant. And if you look at where the industry is going, where we're actually moving toward ACO, toward risk management, it really is incumbent on the organization to have as much data associated with that individual as is possible and make sure once it goes in there, it is accurate and understanding what you're going to do with it. But great point.
In my world, I just cannot ignore dirty data, and let me give you a background of it. We do next-gen sequencing, and in the field over here with the known mutations and biomarkers, it's evolving by the day. So what we consider as dirty data and not relevant may become very relevant tomorrow. So as much as people are talking about petabytes, we're talking about exabytes. And I love my business manager to say, oh, no, you need to store every piece of information because if it's dirty, tomorrow it could become clean. So and I think it's just a tip of the iceberg as we look at different parts of information, not just genomics, but if we look at behavioral, Ginger.io is a little company which takes into consideration your cell phone dialogue. You know, are you keeping in touch with your friends? Because that's sort of a behavioral modification in understanding what your health problems are. So if you look at it in terms of social media, mobility, genomics, it's going to be very hard to say, going back to the question again, you know, the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, what is dirty data today may become actually clean data tomorrow.
And it's actually a good sort of segue, unintentional. All of these segues have been unintentional, by the way. Into looking at some topics related, you know, we talked about this morning the idea of better patient engagement, speaking of adding exabytes of data, especially as meaningful use stage two sort of places that added emphasis on both engagement and also sort of the shared decision-making process. And, you know, as Jay points out, there's all kinds of data that we can bring into that, whether it's from, you know, a patient-facing portal or a personal health record system or the fitness tracking devices folks are increasingly wearing. Sort of viewed through that lens, what can we do to expand sort of our you know, uses of analytics to sort of aid this shared decision-making and sort of care coordination effort? Another highfalutin question. Again,
of which I have no answer to.
Yeah, I can't make questions easy. I'm sorry.
I'll take a shot this one before Jay does because I know she's going to say the same thing I do. I am absolutely an advocate of getting as much patient engagement as is possible. I, as a patient, and I don't even like that term, by the way. I like the term individual or person because that's what we want to manage now. I am the only person that can really affect care to me. So to get me engaged in that process is absolutely essential. I don't care how much data I have, clean or dirty, if I'm not engaged, I'm probably not going to become a more healthy person based on seeing a physician once or twice every 5 years. And I got some personal experience with this, so that's why it resonates with me so much. And for those of you that have heard me speak before, I'm a diabetic, have hypertension. Finally I said, you know what, I'm going to practice what I preach. So I went to a concierge physician who has engaged me personally, and make a long story short, you're always a diabetic, but my A1C is like in the 5 range. My triglycerides, which were 475, are now 150, all because he got me engaged. He didn't change anything I was doing. He didn't get any new medications. He said, you've got an unhealthy lifestyle, and this is what you have to change. So I went back to him and said, now with me engaging, I report to him biweekly through electronic means. So he knows my health habits, whatever they might be. But the biggest thing that he really made me aware of is if I didn't alter that behavior, I asked him specifically, what would be the cost to me or some organization for my long-term care needs? And it was in the range of $7 to $10 million. That was that significant. So that's what got me engaged. That's what the incentive was for me. And I think that is, if we don't start there and if we don't address that part of it, I don't know that, I mean, sure, we can do some great stuff with analytics, but we're really not going to affect the kind of care and well-being of a particular individual.
I figured somebody
would
argue with me.
I look at the show America's Biggest Loser, and I think it teaches a lot of things, right? So here, I mean, for those of you who haven't seen it, is someone who has really not managed to control their weight to the point that they become clinically significantly obese. He doesn't address it by saying, let's touch your point with diet or exercise or that. what are the underlying causes? What is it that motivates you in life? I mean, what is it that you're trying to prove? And, you know, if and a great example I always use is Neil Sofian does this wonderful piece, and he just did that a couple of months ago. He kind of said, you know, it's my 50th wedding anniversary and my school reunion. So those are the two trigger points, and I want to look good, so that's the motivating factor. So I think patient engagement should be looked at from that perspective of a very individual notion of what is it that motivates a person to take care of themselves. I mean, in any other industry, we've had sort of the technology equivalent. Okay, you used a travel agent, now you go use an online mode. You never had a personal filing cabinet called my wellness cabinet where you went and looked into it. This is something which is moving in it because of the trifecta of our diet, the aging of the population, and several pieces of these coming together. And so I think now understanding the underlying trigger factors for a person to be concerned needs to be as much important as actually delivering what they need to do.
And I think that raises a great question, and I'd love the physicians on the panel and in the audience to think about this. But you're not incented, or you're not compensated today to spend an hour with me understanding those kinds of things. So how do we bridge where we are now to where we think we need to go? How are physicians addressing it today, or are they?
Just want to, we have a question from the audience there.
Yes. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Brian. You know, we've got a very esteemed panel up here, and you're letting them off the hook, and so are we, right? So you guys are kind of softballing the answers. So let's get down to brass tacks. Let's stop talking about databases and reports. How many of you are working towards utilizing clinical evidence base at the bedside in real time so that you can influence outcomes as opposed to report on them? Because if you report on them, it's too late. How many do you guys, do you want to address that?
You want the physicians to address it, right? You don't want me to.
That's a very good question. Thank you.
That gets into the workflow question that I was talking about. And so I think most electronic medical records have a sliver, a piece of that, and say drug-to-drug counterindications, that kind of thing. We're seeing some more of that come in, but quite honestly, I think across the scope of whether you want to call it PHR, EMRs, whatever labels you want to put on them, those systems, CPOEs, those systems that are at the point of care have very limited, what I would put under the umbrella of CDS, clinical decision support. And as a cynic, I'd say even a book is clinical decision support, but that's a separate issue. So there's that, but for my experience, that's very, very difficult to get those into those systems, into the EMR systems. And so it's the part of that, from my experience, is doing it with care management at the point of discharge, et cetera. That's not ideal. I agree with you, but it's taking the data from as many different sources and touching it as early in the care process as possible.
There are a number of institutions that are currently utilizing evidence-based care to make levels of care decision, let alone transitions of care across the continuum. And that criteria is in memory. It's fed in addition to EMR, PHR, CPOE, revenue cycle, et cetera, bedside monitors, remote monitors, et cetera. All of that information in memory, so not in a database.
I mean, I can take a stab. The answer is I am.
I hear
a couple of things. Number one, talk about dirty data. The dirtiest freaking data in the world is when a patient walks in with a 7-page single type thing and says, in 1942, I skinned my knee and it turned red. And I had this exact situation Sunday when I worked. And so the dirtiest data is from the patient. So this patient engagement thing is fascinating. And by the way, I believe two companies called Google and Microsoft each actually built a here's where you should put your data, and I think they both gave up, is my understanding. So it's, you know, people are trying. So, but that being said, furthermore, I think it's an oversimplification to think that I'm going to be standing in front of a patient and I'm going to order some things, and somebody smarter than me, like that little Microsoft guy, is going to pop up and say, oh, you didn't think fever, chest pain, cough, pneumonia? Let me help you out. That the funny thing about medicine is that that's the easiest thing in the world. What's hard is the 1 out of 10,000. And that's a very human thing. But to get to your point, when the thing pops up and gives you a suggestion, even that's too late. So really where the bang for the buck is when you, and with EMRs and with order sets, with structured documentation, done well, and some systems do it well, and frankly, most systems do it poorly. You can lead people down a path and reduce the risk or make them think of things just in the structure of how you input the data. So the sad challenge today is that most of the systems, you are documenting what you do to get paid. Okay, that generates 90% of my documentation, which is the government says you have to have 12 review systems to be a level 5, right? And it's a joke. But a really good system is, oh, if you ask this and this question, it makes me think you want to ask that question. And we have that today, and that works well. And also structured order sets can be very helpful because if it's, you say, oh, yeah, I think I should get a pregnancy test. So I think that's a big part of the answer to your question, that how the systems are structured to help you document and how they're structured with order sets. And Dr. Tierney was here. He stepped out. But, you know, we're doing a lot of work on order sets. Those things help you make those good decisions, right? A good order set for elderly fever, for instance. Is that so, in fact, quite a bit's going on. But I'm dubious of the magic decision support tool that's going to help me out and make me think of things that I haven't crossed my mind the first 20 years of practicing medicine.
I would agree with a lot of that. I could just share two things that we've tried to do at Penn that I'm aware of. I haven't personally been intimately involved in these projects, but I know something about how they've gone. And it's two areas that I think a lot of institutions have tried to tackle, readmissions and sepsis. So we've done some, we've implemented some analytics-based feedback to the provider tools there, and you know, both predictive. We put a lot of work into looking at how to predict readmission within 30 days. And I think it's sort of interesting. I mean, we tested lots of, first of all, we had to look at what data we had available to us, a lot of things that you would really like to have that you think might, you hypothesize might be predictive. We just didn't have it, or we didn't have it with the sort of cleanliness or reliability that we thought we could make use of. We fed a bunch of variables into our model, and we ended up coming out with a single variable as the predictor that we thought gave us the best kind of overall performance of the system, and it was whether or not someone had been admitted more than 2 times in the past year. And that's all it was. You know, nothing particularly fancy. But that gave us a very good sensitivity for picking up patients who were likely to be readmitted. It was not very specific, but it was a tool that at least allows us to focus some discharge and care planning interventions that might be costly on a subset of patients. The more clinical example, and maybe a little bit more interesting, is a sepsis sniffer. And I think you guys at Pittsburgh might have something much more advanced in this regard. But we basically looked across our hospitals, feel that our mortality from sepsis is higher than where we'd like it to be. So tried to implement an early warning system that would look at, once we made all of our vital signs data electronic and so had some other kind of electronic sources of data that we didn't previously have, we thought it was a good opportunity to try to do this. And so we implemented something relatively simple. If you're familiar with the SIRS criteria, it's kind of a, you know, a standard criteria for judging when someone's starting to move towards sepsis based on their physiologic characteristics. And we implemented the SIRS criteria plus two other variables that we added in that seemed to be predictive from our historical data set. And we implemented this early warning system. We've learned a lot. The sort of interesting thing about it is we've done this at 3 hospitals. One hospital saw a statistically significant decrease in mortality. It's difficult for us to look at outcomes. We can look at mortality. We can look at ICU transfers. We can't necessarily look at real characteristics about who got septic and who didn't because of the clinical definition there. Across all 3 hospitals, we saw a change in practice. The early warning system led to people prescribing a lot more antibiotics and transferring a lot more people to the intensive care unit. At one hospital, we saw a decrease in mortality. If we surveyed providers to say, you know, do you feel that this has been helpful to you? And About 20% of them said that they, you know, they thought that it it really changed their mind. You know, a lot of the time they think it's telling them something that they already know. Sometimes it comes down to nuances of timing, and we've had to have a lot of iteration back and forth with the providers to find out, you know, where it was working and where it was not working. So in some cases, we're sending them a page to tell them that the patient is hypotensive just after they got off the phone with the ER physician who just told them the same thing. It's already known it's not a value add, but in other cases it is a value add and it's helping to catch people who might otherwise be missed. So I guess all that to say, we're just at the kind of very beginning of trying to do this, and it's challenging, but we're learning from it.
Yeah, it seems from the answers to your question is that we really need almost, I don't know if you said it or I just thought in my head that we really, it looks like we're moving toward a cultural shift, and it seems like we've got sort of the population health management aspect of analytics kind of figured out, and what we're trying to do is, as you described, is kind of take this leap toward almost personalized medicine in a sense, and that to do that, you know, we may need better systems that can better aggregate that data. We may need more to bring in more data, and we may need to present it in a way that, as you noted, isn't just sort of repeating what folks already know, but is giving that value add. And yet another highfalutin question, but what will it take for us to sort of get there? I mean, do we have sort of easy wins that we can present to our clinical staff to say, hey, here's some tangible evidence that this is going to work, and I think you presented a couple there, and maybe some others to share as well.
So in my world, the NCCN guidelines for oncology are very much there, but that's like a telephone book, right? So the content is there, but how are you going to use it? So what we had to do is really divide it into three parts. If you're thinking about interoperability in the regular EMRs being awful, then think about the oncology EMRs and all of them. I mean, one of them even mentioned to them they didn't know what CCAL was, just to give you an idea of the level of interoperability. So trying to get to a seamless interface, as you're saying, is going to be the place where perfect will be the enemy of good. So we really had to divide it into three pieces. So the way we're working is creating the order sets, putting them into the EMR. We are taking these NCCN guidelines and converting them into a therapeutic pathway, which is decision-based, based upon the individuals. Are they in stage 3? What is the performance status? Providing a pathway for it. Providing what is the current therapy, which is FDA approved, what is the emerging therapy, or where are the clinical trials? So it is, I think someone mentioned over here, it's a question of we know what needs to be done, but categorizing the information, not necessarily using any superfluous AI needs at this point, but really being able to give context-specific information is one way of what we are doing in terms of taming the beast, if I may say so.
I think to follow up on your specific question, again, I'm not a provider, but what I have seen is, again, the work done at UPMC around the whole telehealth piece of it, and that is capturing as much data and proving to the care provider it's much easier, cost-efficient, and programmatic to care for the patient at home and change that entire culture. So I think that's an example of how you use this information. But I want to go back to a point Mark made, because I think he was absolutely spot on. And we've got to capture this information, as you suggested. But quite frankly, that's too late. We got to do it up front. And these tools that we're talking about have to be in place for an organization to manage the wellness state, to manage the disease state, to manage the triage state, to make sure the patient never gets there. But when they get there, they got to have it, that kind of information. So I think sometimes when we think about analytics, one thing we don't do is define what it really is. What are the components that we're really striving? What are the issues we're striving to address? So I think great point.
Well, and I didn't think this was the analytics session. This was the ACO session. And so making people accountable and is a lot about, so one answer question, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit around resource utilization. And we've had good success there. And I gave you an anecdote earlier, but we have a number of them where we just start to present the data on our providers using resources that, and by the way, you don't get traction when you say you're spending a lot of money. People at this point don't want to hear that. Where we've got interesting traction, though, and I think you've observed things change in the last 3 years, is people increasingly accept, as do the patients, that radiation is not a good thing. And that really wasn't true 5 years ago, but I mean, you're a radiation oncologist, but I mean, the radiologists now are very tuned into radiation. And so we can go to our providers and say, you're a big user of CTs of the abdomen and pelvis, and you're bigger than everybody else, and again, we don't discern that you're seeing different patients or diagnosing things others are missing. And even and you can say that to the patients now, and they're surprisingly tuned into it versus a few years ago. So I think the low-hanging fruit right now I think physicians are pretty good at what they do in the United States for the most part. I think they're very good, but we're consuming a lot of resources doing that, and that's evolving. I think the magic point of care thing on my shoulder that's going to make me think of things or do things that otherwise I would have missed, at least as an emergency physician, I think that's not around the corner.
A couple of things that seem to be coming out as a theme. One, from a micro perspective, I think what you're talking about oftentimes is awareness. Awareness to your peers, we've found, is a very strong motivator. And so that's a tactical move. And then there's the business. This is hard. We've all talked about this is hard, but there's a lot of good components in there. But if there's not a business model to support how hard this is, a la ACO or MSSP or something of that nature, then it's much more difficult to align the resources to take on the challenge. And I think that's a very important component of this whole thing.
Well, I think I read somewhere that 60% of patient interactions in the Kaiser system today are electronic. And yet, you know, for the people that I work with, which are, you know, standard U.S. model primary care or other physicians that get paid if you take half your day off and go to their office and see them 15 minutes, that's how the doctor gets paid. A phone call to the doctor, and God forbid, an email, that doesn't, it's not reimbursable. So, but again, where we're having traction now in our early stage risk contracting is we literally are showing the conscious people and saying, here's the data we're looking at, and it isn't that hard. It's hemoglobin A1C, you know, it's you know, diabetics, and it's patients with things like, you know, asthma, are you on a steroid inhaler? So those are nice little things. I mean, you either are on a steroid inhaler or you're not. Right? You either have an appointment with the eye doctor or you don't. And but you'd be surprised how, when we first look at it, how poorly that's being done, and then we start to focus on it and introduce it and report on it and how much it changes. It really changes quickly.
I wanted to see, as we only have a few minutes left, any other questions from the audience, any thoughts? Speak now or forever hold your peace.
So you kind of touched on the personalized components of analytics. I'm just really interested in hearing, you know, what you really think the forefront of personalized analytics would be and how you would apply it.
So, you know, there's the gamut of personalized medicine has gotten a nomenclature as large as self, right? So do you call it personalized information, do you call it individualized information, or do you call it preferential-based medicine? So they basically, to that is many, a very vast segment. Some of them are easily done. I mean, for example, preferential-based medicine is as simple in certain cases, having advanced directives recorded, or by what is said, I mean, I think there's a health affairs case study, which somebody may have seen, where this particular nurse, who did not want the length of life to be extended, but rather the quality of the life to be at its peak, chose a regimen which would enable her to perform at the peak quality of life until she succumbed to her terminal illness. So I think in terms of individualized medicine, if you're talking about preferential medicine, that's already there. In genomics, I think the advances are going quite strongly. I mean, we now know certain medications, including even in cardiology, where Plavix has an effect and Plavix does not have an effect. So I think there are certain aspects in terms of where we're going. There, reimbursement is another question, right? Cigna just came out with an announcement yesterday saying, oh, unless you have genetic counseling, we're not going to pay for any of the genetic testing going on. And then the last aspect of it, I think, in terms of what do you prefer, which, again, I think belongs to the category of, do I want just allopathy, or do I want, I wouldn't call it alternative medicine, but more sort of comprehensive medicine, which is aromatherapy included and everything else. I think those pieces, we're at least seeing payers beginning to cover some aspects of it. So long-winded question, we're seeing those things coming together, and that's why I look at the data warehouse as not clean data or dirty data, or for that matter, there's no destination. As we go in, there'll be more data towards individualized medicine. Sorry for the long answer.
So, I mean, this is already happening, right? I mean, you see it in breast oncology, and you probably know more about it than me, but you're seeing now if you have a breast cancer, before you just, it wasn't very long ago that everybody put on the same regimen, and now we're understanding, wait a minute, it depends on what actual breast cancer illness you have, and so you're going to see the same thing true in hypertension management, by the way. It's incredibly crude today that we say everybody will be on a beta blocker, and you're already seeing now some beta blocker data where you do like a gene profile and say, well, that beta blocker is right for you, but it's not right for you. So I think in terms of personalized analytics, that's where it's going to go, is figuring out a more nuanced way to treat people with medications.
Okay, just wanted to ask as sort of a... Oh, is there another one?
I was just going to follow that up real quick. So then how do you get that in terms of position to the point of care?
Oh. So you talked about having that information, you know, this beta blocker versus this one. So how do you actually get that for every physician? How do you make it easy for them to say, oh, okay, you should have warfarin or you should not? Or...
But I see that already all the time, particularly in oncology, right? I mean, I think it's becoming fairly standard in oncology, depending on what your illness is, that you get a genetic screen, and that determines what treatment. So I think that's underway.
Now, are you referring to sort of that generalized information, or more of that specific, you know, that more personalized sort of like Fitbit data or something like that? Is that what you mean?
The generalized data. So, mm-hmm. You know, if I can understand doing a screening when you're putting someone on a drug regimen, but how about if you're, you know, you don't even know that they could have a genetic disease and you do a general screening and then you find one? Is that kind of interesting to you, or do you want to stay away from across-the-board screening?
Well, I mean, that's a whole other... That gets you into a whole... What's wrong? You know, that's like screening nuns for HIV, right? Mm-hmm. If you screen nuns for HIV with a test that's 99.9% specific, most nuns that you tell HIV don't have it. Mm-hmm. So that's a much more complicated question.
Okay. Thank you.
And then if you use something which is sort of the consumer-based 23andMe or so, the question is, how valid is the test? But I do think that's where the new, if I may sort of put a plug here, that's what we believe is the holy grail of oncology, where we sit from. We believe that the large academic institutions have their powerhouses of data and research, but what is a community oncologist going to do outside, where he has to deal not just with one type of cancer, but multiple cancers? How do we distill the information in NCCN, distill the information in the clinical trials, and also the emerging therapies, and be able to say, not just we did the genomic testing and here's a report, but what does that report mean? How do you interpret that? How do you communicate to that patient? And what do you have to do in terms of treatment? That's what we believe is the future. And that's what we are sort of progressing as part of our business model.
And what should you not do?
Exactly. And what you should not do.
So,
right?
So in that case, it's like a combination of data sharing and then collaboration, which opens up many, many other Pandora's boxes, which unfortunately we do not have time to address as we've sort of hit our time limit. Wanted to thank our panelists for their insight and to thank the audience for their attention and their questions.
Thank you very much, Brian, and thank you again, panelists, for your insight. We're going to take a quick break, 10 minutes, and remember there's two tracks. So coming up next in track one here in this room, Don Fitzgerald, CEO of QSource, is going to be giving a case study. And then in track two downstairs, we have Vicki Welch and Hakim Lanai from Informatics Center for Excellence of Cancer Care, Ontario. So tough choice. We'll see you back in 10 minutes. Thanks.